The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Euro Special. Bayern win the Super Cup over Borussia Dortmund. Julian Nagelsmann's first win as Bayern boss, and now he wants to start hoarding titles. He's probably in the right place. Ronaldo breaks his silence and attempts to end all the speculation about his future. It's just a little vague about it, so let's speculate about his future and then decide he'll probably stay at Juve. Elsewhere in Italy, is Dzeko for Lukaku enough for Inter? And will Tammy Abraham have a nice time in Rome? We salute Gerard Piqué for taking a pay cut and scoring a goal. Obviously, we'd all do the same, but unless he was paid $1 billion a year, then Barca are still in a financial mess. Yet rumours persist over signings. With what money? Elsewhere in Spain, Eric Lamela, goal machine. And in France, something something Lionel Messi. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, a first pod of the season, live from Cologne, from Archie Rintutt. Hello, Archie.
Hello, Max.
Lars Sivertsen, welcome.
Hi, Max.
And Nicky Bandini, hello.
Hi, Max.
Let's start in Germany, shall we? The Super Cup. Bayern Dortmund 1, Bayern 3, you were there. Did you have a nice time?
I did, Max.
I'm pleased.
Particularly with the kiss cam at half time. I forget the football. I think that was the highlight last night. It started off, shall we say, classic couples.
Right.
And
okay.
then it moved to these two burly bald blokes who both had their arms around one another, and there was kind of this anticipation as if a striker was going through on goal. It was like, go on. Go on. And one of them just absolutely went for it and the crowd erupted. And you're like, yes, 2021, this is what it's about. Until 20 seconds later, it then goes to two girls in their 20s. And then suddenly you just felt this kind of altogether more gruff vibe from the dads in the stadium.
Oh, no.
And when they kissed, there was a much kind of manlier roar. And you're just like, okay, so maybe there's some work to do here.
I've got to say, kiss cams. I mean, like, the line between American things coming into football, surely that is crossed when you bring in kiss cams.
I just want to marvel at the fact that we've gone from we can't have football fans in stadiums to now encouraging strangers to kiss each other. That feels like such an extraordinary step. Like, we're so far through to the other side of this. I almost can't believe that's real.
Well, it was juxtaposed as well with announcements over the tannoy being like, if you leave your seat, please make sure you put on your mask. And it's like half time. Well, go on.
That's like in Scotland a couple of weeks ago in nightclubs where you have to wear a mask walking to the bar or to the dance floor. But once you're on the dance floor, well, you're free to do whatever you like. And you're like, who made that rule has never been on a dance floor, have they? Anyway, let's talk about the football. I guess we should, Archie.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I mean, it was a feisty game. Like, I was wondering, is this a charity shield? Do people really care? But, like, there were fiery challenges going in.
Yeah, one of my more weathered colleagues was saying at half-time that this game has a much more intense feel to it than the Super Cup used to have. And you could tell as well, because you have two new coaches in Marco Rosa at Borussia Dortmund and Julian Nagelsmann at Bayern, who are both looking to set down early markers for the season, both under pressure for different reasons. Julian Nagelsmann hadn't won a competitive game or a non-competitive game with Bayern until last night. He hadn't won any of his friendlies and held to a 1-1 draw on Friday night against Borussia Mönchengladbach. And Marco Rosa, who is coming into Borussia Dortmund after they finished so well under interim coach Edin Terzic, who's now moved into this technical director role where he sits alongside CEO Hans-Joachim Watzke, and you're thinking, if things start to go south, that whole TV picture of Watzke sitting next to Terzic could loom quite a lot. But you say that Bayern improved a lot from when I saw them against Gladbach on Friday night. Julian Nagelsmann, who I spoke to after the game, was very happy with how they pressed in the first 15 minutes. Still, it took a typical / remarkable save from Manuel Neuer at 0-0, from Marco Reus through on goal, just with the outside of his foot managing to steer it round the post. And then Bayern were able to get ahead through Robert Lewandowski, who made a run from deep. You expected him to be in and around where Dortmund centre-back Manuel Akanji was, but you could tell in the moment that the ball flew across from Serge Gnabry that there was just kind of this beat of the Dortmund defenders going, hang on a minute, isn't this where Lewandowski's meant to be? And then that was the time when he arrived. And particularly for Lewandowski to score last night and twice after a really bad mistake from Manuel Akanji in the second half, I think was also just a little reminder to Erling Haaland that, yeah, I'm still top dog in Germany right now. Even if the Dortmund crowd was baying for Haaland to score, the atmosphere is a lot more spontaneous right now in the stadiums, Max, compared to when the ultras are usually marking their territory and you kind of have this low, dull thud of their chants, which are only about the teams. You're getting more chants about players, and that's not very typical in Germany as well. And I kind of enjoy it because it interacts with the game a lot more as it's going on, rather than just kind of being this kind of consistent drumbeat. And I think it's making things live a bit more right now.
Alexander says, why are Dortmund incapable of playing against Bayern without gifting them two easy goals? Is it some German tradition that I'm not aware of?
So defensively last night, they didn't have their first choice back four. Felix Paslak at right back, who Norwich City fans may remember, he was really struggling, particularly the first 15 minutes. He was robbed a couple of times and Dortmund were fortunate not to be taken advantage of there. Axel Witsel is not the first choice centre-back, and Nico Schulz is also second choice to Rafael Guerrero. But you would say that if there's one thing that's going to cut Dortmund down in the title race, it is their defence. They've brought in Gregor Kobel in goal, who shone at Stuttgart last season, seems much more assured with the ball at his feet than Roman Bürki does. But the tougher tests are to really come for Borussia Dortmund. I thought that in phases last night, they looked really good. Mo Dahoud in particular is showing a lot more bite in defensive midfield than he has before. We know about his ability to spray these immaculate passes, and there was this disallowed goal last night for Erling Haaland where he played the most outrageous ball with the outside of his right foot. But I think the bigger question is, how well are they going to be able to implement the kind of pressing that Marco Rosa wants? And we'll see this weekend when they go to Freiburg, because Freiburg is a very good indicator of how ready you are to challenge for a Bundesliga title. If you want to win a Bundesliga title, go to Freiburg and win, because they're just that sort of tricky mid-table opponent that too often Dortmund have come unstuck against.
A Freiburg Stoke, is that what that sounds like?
Freiburg's too lovely. But I don't want to insult Stoke, because I've had good times at Stoke. namely being one of only 90 Fulham fans being there on a cold Monday night and seeing us go down 3-0 inside half an hour and thinking, well, can it get any worse? But no, Freiburg's not Stoke. I'd say Augsburg has more of a Stoke vibe.
Lars, can I ask about Erling Haaland? Everyone expects him to go at the end of next season, and sort of where he could possibly go, and that does bleed into, I know it's a Europod, but that makes me think that City might hold on. You know, Haaland in a year for 75 or 90 million euros, whatever the release is better than Harry Kane for 150 million pounds, isn't it?
Yes, I don't. My very subjective, entirely speculative theory is that they would prefer to send him to Spain before eventually maybe sending him to England later in his career. That kind of makes more sense. And I suspect, and again, this is me speculating, I suspect Real Madrid has kind of been the plan. But I guess the landscape of European football has shifted a little bit the last couple of years. And currently Real Madrid are completely obsessed with the notion of bringing Kylian Mbappe in. And even if the release clause next summer pushes the transfer fee down, the finances of bringing both Mbappe and Haaland in are not easy to make work if you're Real Madrid and you don't have infinite funds. So I think that potentially could be tricky.
Archie, what's your wild speculation on Haaland?
He will undoubtedly stay for now, I think.
Oh yeah, sorry, I should specify next summer. There's no chance of him leaving this summer whatsoever. Sorry.
I think he'll stay, but I agree with Lars. I think Spain or England is the most likely destination. He started the season like a train. Even last night, he was very lively. Up until last night, he'd been involved in all 8 of Dortmund's goals, whether scoring or assisting. And he showed the sort of petulance in injury time that I think I've last seen really in its true glory when I was playing back garden football with my cousins, when he managed to get a shot away, but it was off target. But he got it off as he was brought down. It wasn't a penalty. Anyway, it's 92nd minute. Haaland goes behind the goal, picks up the ball, and walks towards the penalty spot. And there he finds the referee, and he's like, "It's a penalty." And at this point, if it was me and my cousins, we would usually let my younger cousin take his penalty and go away. However, there was the referee, and he's like, "It's a goal kick." And Haaland just kind of threw the ball down. And was like, "What's this about? What's going on?"
So I want to ask you, Archie, about the crowd and the atmosphere in particular, since you were there, because I watched this on TV, and it sounded raucous is one thing, but also I thought there was a period, specifically after the 2-1 goal, there was a sort of 5-minute period where the crowd was really getting behind the team and getting excited, thinking the comeback was on. And Dortmund were really pressing, like it was sort of Klopp-esque the way they were flying forwards, everyone going. And you sort of thought, wow, you know, this is the future of Dortmund, what's happening here now. And then immediately Akanji gave the ball away stupidly and Bayern score 3-1. And I kind of felt that was where Dortmund are right now in a nutshell, really.
There's a real excitement every time the ball goes near Erling Haaland. You feel the pitch of the crowd go up a notch. But also one player I'd credit for the atmosphere is England's own Jude Bellingham, who has made a routine now out of the first 2 home games of just before kickoff, going around each corner of the Dortmund half and kind of putting his arms up and trying to rouse the crowd and saying to them, come on, like, we need your energy. And he was doing that throughout the game last night as well. And I thought that he was bringing the energy as well. When he came off, standing ovation from the fans, even if it was at 3-1, I think that was the biggest noise that the crowd made after that third goal by Bayern. So he's also impressive, and also a really lovely touch of him going into the crowd last night to give his shirt to a fan in a wheelchair just off camera, I think it was. And yeah, Ike, from my experience of interviewing the guy, very down to earth, cheeky chap from Birmingham, and I'm very excited to see where his career goes, particularly because of the energy that he brings to this Dortmund side, and it very much fits with the pressing that Marco Rosa wants to implement.
In the absence of any other old grumpy panelists, is it grumpy of me to find it really annoying when players go to the crowd and go, "Come on!" Like
yes.
And it's so easy because like the crowd just, they don't give it any thought. It's like, yeah, God, you know. And I'm sure I would do it if a Cambridge player did it in front of my face, but it just seems too easy. Like, Haaland did it after Marco Rose's goal was beautiful, but like Haaland was there just going, "Come on!" I don't know.
Well, you don't want players to G up the crowd.
No, I just find it really... it's too easy to get... It should be harder to get a big
easy?
Cheer.
You keep saying it's too easy. Do you need it to be harder? Do you need it to be like, instead of have to sit down and fill in a form?
Yeah, they need to solve like a Rubik's Cube first, and then they can go...
Yeah, in my experience of trying to get an ovation from a crowd, it's harder than that. I'm jealous. But all they have to do is go, "Come on." Everyone goes, "Oh, God, yeah." Although once I was doing a corporate event for Sky... with all the it was like all the call centers, you know, it was like the awards for who'd done the best, and they had a, like, it was a really fun night and everyone was lovely there, but,
and you're saying,
you
know, there weren't like, standing ovations from the call centers.
No,
they were completely like, who is this?
No, Lars, there was like a table from Doncaster, a table from Edinburgh, you know, a table from Livingston, and all you had to do was yell Doncaster, and literally like 50 people would just go wild. So I suppose that was my experience. But I came off feeling empty, feeling this was too easy. This was too easy. You need to earn it. Anyway, Bayern on the pitch. Charlie says, do you think they'll go into the market? Sabitzer might come in. What do they need? Do they need anything?
Yes, some strength and depth, some flexible players who they've lost in David Alaba, Javi Martinez, players who can play in multiple positions. And that's been one of the biggest talking points in Germany, is Bayern's lack of strength and depth. And if there were injuries too, I mean, if Robert Lewandowski gets injured for a prolonged period of time, is something you could say for the last however many years, and it's never happened, not since he was in the Polish third division. So you can keep waiting for that one, even if he did have a little spell on the sidelines last season. But in other areas, particularly defensively, Buna Sarr has looked well out of his depth whenever he has played for Bayern. The crux of why Hansi Flick left was because his input wasn't being heeded by sporting director Hasan Salihamidžić. So yes, I think signings are definitely wanted there. It's whether Bayern are able to spend enough, which will I think determine what they get in the end. We should mention, Max, obviously the win for Bayern last night coming just after the passing of Gerd Müller, and how big that has been in Germany, and understandably so. Bayern Munich's record goal scorer, the Bundesliga's record goal scorer for Germany on many occasions in a World Cup, and on one occasion even in a World Cup final. And I spoke to Thomas Müller last night, and Thomas Müller is, I think, renowned when he's speaking English for this jokey tone, for his Lewandowski quote, etc. But you just saw his face and his whole demeanour change as soon as mentioned him. He worked under Gerd Müller, who was an assistant coach later in his career. And he really emphasised the significance of Müller to Bayern as a club today. Without Gerd Müller, Bayern is not the club that it is today. But also, the club was there for Gerd Müller when he went through difficult times off the pitch. He was calmness personified in front of goal. He just always found a way. And the fact that he has a verb after him in German to score, to Müller, I think tells you just how big an impact that he left on the game was. He also scored goals off a diet of potato salad, and that's not something that we should underestimate either.
What, just potato salad?
He wasn't one of these players who'd go drinking with the lads. He would go home to his wife, Ushi, and enjoy her company and have his potato salad. And that was enough for Gerd to score all the goals that he wanted. 365, by the way, in the Bundesliga. That makes him the record goal scorer in the competition. But here's to potato salad and scoring goals.
It's just put me in mind of another player who just had an incredible knack for scoring goals, Pippo Inzaghi, who famously only used to eat bresaola and rice. That's like cured beef and rice was like his meal all the time. And then these kids' biscuits called Plasma, and that was supposedly all he ate through a lot of his playing career. And now I'm fascinated by this idea that really good strikers, to be the best striker, actually you just need to be very consistent at mealtime. Get on with your one meal and move on.
Just one thing on strikers and eating habits. I was once filming something at Leicester when they were in the Champions League, and it was in the morning and players were coming through the doors at the entrance and everyone was being very polite and morning. And then suddenly the double doors just burst open and it's Jamie Vardy, and he just goes, morning, and he has this massive saveloy in his hand, and he just takes a bite and walks on, and you're like, ah, yes, The king has arrived. Lovely.
Savoy and vodka Red Bull. A dream dinner. You've got 1 minute to tell us about Wolfsburg and Goat Cam in Cologne.
So Cologne got off to a winning start to the season with their new coach, Stefan Baumgart, who we shall now christen as Peaky Baumgart because of his flat cap that he's chosen to wear for this season. And Hennis the Ninth. Cologne had a camera on him, and the main thing that you can see is his dangling testicles as Florian Kainz scored Cologne's second goal. Well worth searching out, I'm sure. In other news, in football news, Wolfsburg have been booted out of the DFB Cup because they subbed in one too many players. They tried consulting the fourth official Tobias Fritsch, but to no avail. They were sent letters by the DFB saying that there would only be five substitutes allowed. They brought on a sixth in injury in extra time against Preußen Münster of the fourth tier, who understandably put in a complaint because I think like most lower league clubs right now, they need the cash. So it's Preußen Münster who go through. Wolfsburg tried to, in the commercial department, try to make light of this by saying for their first home game of the season that if you bought five tickets, you get the sixth one free.
Which I thought was didn't the fourth official smart, but, the office fourth official just say I'm not telling you, like, I'll just say can we make this sub? And the fourth official's going, well, you can, and I can't tell you this. Like, seems really quite cruel.
I mean, I found it odd that he wouldn't know either himself, but Mark van Bommel, Wolfsburg's new coach, has paid the price, and yeah, Champions League playing Wolfsburg are out of the cup.
It is good to see Van Bommel, even now in a coaching capacity, showing complete disregard for the rules that apply to the game. He's really metaphorically two-footing the substitute, but of course, unfortunately, being pulled up for it here, which is not quite as on brand.
All right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll start with Italy. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Nicky, Ronaldo has broken his silence in an Instagram post, which was incredibly long. But the bit at the bottom cleared things up, or it didn't at all. Just said, I'm breaking my silence now to say that I can't allow people to keep playing around with my name. I remain focused on my career and in my work, committed and prepared for all the challenges that I have to face. Everything else is just talk. Winky emoji. I mean, is that I'm happy at Juve, or is that I'm just looking forward to all the challenges, whatever they may be? I mean, we do care, don't we? Because where he plays is a big story.
Yeah, I saw the headlines that this Instagram post generated before I saw the Instagram post, and to me, the two things didn't match up because I read a lot of stories that Ronaldo is staying at Juventus. And then I read the post and I said, he doesn't mention Juventus at all, actually.
No,
the word Juventus is not in that post. And nowhere does it really say, I'm happy where I am, I'm staying where I am. It certainly expresses anger and frustration at people speculating about his future. And if you choose to read it that way, you could say, okay, well, what he means to say is, I'm sick of all this speculation, there's nothing to speculate about. But he doesn't say that. So to me, it was a post that left things open to interpretation and to going different ways. Certainly there's certainly noise that he doesn't really want to go through the last year of his contract at Juventus, and there's certainly people in Turin who think that perhaps it might be best for everybody if he wasn't at Juventus this season. Not that he hasn't been brilliant, because he scored more than 80 goals in about 90 games. He's been ridiculously productive, but he is also I think 36 now, and Juventus are starting over for the third time in three seasons. Okay, they're starting over with Max Allegri, who's been there before and who's won there before. There is at least some feeling that this might be the time to say, all right, let's actually make a plan that goes beyond what's in front of our noses, rather than just trying to sort of muddle through as we've done the last few years. I think there's this fascinating dynamic going on alongside this at Juventus. Paolo Dybala is going into the last year of his contract. Juventus have been trying to get him to sign a new contract. There is this widely repeated narrative that Allegri's back and that's good for Dybala because Dybala scored 22 goals in his second to last season under Allegri and that was the best season of his career. But actually, Dybala's last season under Allegri, when Ronaldo arrived, Dybala scored 5 goals and spent a lot of the season behind Mandzukic because Allegri was convinced that to get the best out of Ronaldo, you had to give him someone like Mandzukic, which Dybala is a very different sort of player. And I think there's a lot knotted up in this at the moment. Allegri, right in one of his first press conferences, said Ronaldo's going to have greater responsibility this season. He's got to be a leader for our young players. And also just drops in, he's got to accept that he's going to be rotated just like everybody else. And he's going to have to take some games off to stay fresh. So the dynamic to me is it's not a bad dynamic. I'm not trying to paint this as a picture that's toxic and terrible. It's just a TBC dynamic. It's a to be confirmed. And I didn't personally feel, and I'm certain that there are going to be some Ronaldo enthusiasts out there, because there always are when you talk about Ronaldo, who feel that I am not expressing the right interpretation of what he said. But I felt that post was very open to interpretation.
I completely agree. He basically said, it wasn't quite a come and get me plea, but it wasn't, I love what I'm doing, Lars.
I mean, no one on the planet will pay him what he's on at Juventus anyway this summer, so it doesn't matter. He might want to go, unless he's taking a hefty wage cut. I don't think he's going anywhere.
It's almost as if somebody else has just got a major deal at another club, and he wants a, and somebody else would want a taste of that. I don't know.
Can't think of who you're suggesting.
It's not going to happen, and so it's just silly to even say it, but wouldn't it be fun if PSG did just go, sure, why not?
But where would they play him? Like holding midfield? Why does he play
instead of having 3 forwards who refuse to move without the ball, we'll now have 4. It would be tremendous.
No, I think as you get older, you just, you know, I was a centre forward for years and eventually I had a couple of seasons at centre back, and that's just where he'd go, you know? And, you know, you just do the simple things. I think that would be, I would love to see that. Is the whole of Juve's season, right? You know, they're favourites, aren't they? And do you think they will win the league?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, this Ronaldo narrative as well, because, as you say, this is where I'm sort of always hedging a bit, like, he is still Ronaldo and he still scores heaps. And actually, if he did leave, this would be the summer when Lukaku left Serie A, Donnarumma left Serie A, Hakimi left Serie A, and Ronaldo left Serie A, which, it's already not been, for the league as a whole, a good summer at all for branding point of view. And Conte left as well. He's another sort of big name who gets people's eyes on what you're doing. So the league has suffered this summer, which is strange because it's been this extraordinary summer for Italian sport in general. It's been a genuinely once-in-a-lifetime summer in Italian sport. With winning the Euros, they won 40 medals at the Olympics, which is more than Italy have ever won Olympics before. They had 10 golds, which is more than Italy have ever had. They included the men's 100 metres, which is always one of those flagship events that people get very excited about. And yet, Serie A does feel a bit diminished because Inter, in particular, and I think we talked about this already when Lukaku's move was getting close, they really are diminished. You've taken away not just the striker who scored the most goals and had the most assists on the team, but the figurehead, the one who the fans related to, the one they made murals of. You've taken him away. You've taken away Hakimi, who, I mean, you know, for his age and for one season in Serie A was extraordinary. I think it's worth saying, to provide some counterbalance, because it's easy to completely overstate as well, this is still a team that had the best defence in the league, and that defence is all there. This is still a team that has Nicola Barella in midfield, that's still got Lautaro Martinez up front, and they've signed Edin Dzeko. To me, it's really hard to sell this as anything other than a pretty disappointing downgrade to go from Lukaku to a 35-year-old striker who was injured a bit last season. If you want to be optimistic about it, Dzeko is still talented, does offer something slightly different to Lukaku, might play better to what Lautaro wants, might be able to be the one who, by being a bit more of a back-to-goal centre-forward, someone who's willing to just be the pivot a bit more, might actually serve Lautaro, who is a very talented striker in his own right and who has a lot of his career still ahead of him. So I don't know that it's sort of total disaster season at Inter, but you've taken away some really important stuff. You haven't really replaced it to the same standard. Meanwhile, Juventus have brought back a manager who is one of the best managers in Europe, in my opinion. and who knows where he is and what he's doing. And while Juventus haven't had a particularly brilliant summer, they are about to sign Manuel Locatelli, who is exactly what they need. The biggest problem with Juventus' team last season was the central midfield. They really didn't have someone who you felt comfortable to trust putting their foot on the ball and being the distributor in the middle. Locatelli's a bit of a hybrid. He can do the box-to-box, he can do the Regista stuff, but I think in that midfield, he's just going to have to be that person who can exert a bit of control, which is the thing that Juventus really missed last season. So, yes, it feels to me like Juventus are the favourites, but I don't think it's as foregone a conclusion as you might imagine. And also, I will say, because the more I look at the Napoli squad and think to myself, well, they haven't sold anybody. Spalletti, well, better than Gattuso. I would certainly say he's got a more impressive CV than Gattuso. And it really depends if they get to the end of the transfer window without having sold anybody. But Napoli were very good last season when they were all healthy. Victor Osimhen, their record signing, was injured a lot. If he's there, if Spalletti gets things right, maybe there's another dark horse in that picture that people haven't spoken about a lot about yet.
John says, Tammy Abraham to Roma. Value for money? I only ask because I used to be his PE teacher.
I mean, it's always interesting when a player joins from the Premier League to Serie A, because I cover Serie A. I've probably seen fewer full Tammy Abraham games than Chelsea fans have. You know, they see him more than I do. But it's a really interesting transfer. I think he very different style of striker to Edin Dzeko. I think for Roma, this actually is a huge relief to get Dzeko off the wage bill. He's been there for a long time, weighing down that wage bill, and as good as he has been, he is getting up in years, and actually the team has not had a centre forward like Abraham, who will run in behind, who wants to play on the shoulder of the defender, for a minute. And if you give them that with what they have got, which is quite abundant collection of players who are very comfortable playing behind the attack, Nicolò Zaniolo is the one everyone wants to see come back and be who he was before his first cruciate ligament 18 months ago, one of the great talents of Italian football up to that point, emerging talents. But even if he never is what he was before, you've got Lorenzo Pellegrini, you've got Mkhitaryan, you've got players who can do things behind the attack. And so I'm fascinated with Abraham. I think it could be a really great fit. I just don't know what to expect. It's a Mourinho team. Mourinho's been producing some pretty underwhelming football for a few years. Can he be the good Mourinho of the past, or is it going to be that stodgy, frustrating, tear your hair out, boring stuff that we've seen sometimes when in the last couple of seasons in the Premier League? I will say, it's a cliche, but it's still true. Italy is a league that doesn't have that directness and pace to the game. Well, some teams do increasingly, but still hasn't had it as widespread as, say, the Premier League does. And I think that Abraham's pace is a really interesting dynamic. I'm excited to see Abraham at Serie A. And I think that Abraham is one of those players who a lot of Chelsea fans, from what I gather, maybe do feel like didn't get as much of a crack of the whip as he should have done after Tuchel came in last season. So I think Abraham is a really fascinating ingredient in that mix.
Yeah, I think more people should move abroad, and I think it can only make the things that they do better. David says,
"It's too easy, Max. It's too easy."
Yeah, you're right. Come on, waving my hands. Come on, cheer. David says, "Could Nicky please give us some more interesting facts about hipster favourites Atalanta and Sassuolo for the season ahead, so we may appear more learned when discussing Italian football in the pub?"
Atalanta, I feel like people should know about Atalanta by now. If people haven't been paying attention to Atalanta over the last four seasons of getting into the Champions League, then probably they don't want to pay attention at this point, I would conclude. They are the great, consistent machine in Italian football right now, because you take pieces away from them. You take away the player who I thought was the one indispensable one, Papu Gomez, and you think, well, okay, something's got to give, and it never does. They always find a slightly different way of playing, a way to adjust, a way to be better. This summer it's Cristiano Romero, who's going to join Tottenham. I thought he was brilliant last season, and such an important player in the way that he stepped out from defence, so aggressive. But do I expect that it will have a significant impact on them? No, because it never seems to. Gasperini always finds a different way to get the best out of his team. And look, again, if ever there was going to be a season for someone like Atalanta to really make a run at it, this might be the season, with everything a bit up in the air. But Again, I don't know what to say. People don't already know. They're a team that play very much the one-on-one battles. They're a player who play, a team that plays slightly on the edge sometimes because they trust their players to win the one-on-one battles. They've got some extraordinary players. I think Robin Gosens is one of the best wing-backs in the world. Martin Deron has been brilliant in midfield alongside Remo Freuler for the last couple of seasons. And Duvan Zapata up front bangs the goals in. Malinovsky has stepped up a lot since Papu Gomez went. I could go on. But they're a really fun, enjoyable team to watch. Sassuolo have lost the manager who was the one who had them playing this sort of quick one-touch football, Roberto De Zerbi. But last season, very much all about the one-touch, rapid strike football under De Zerbi. We'll see if that changes now he's gone.
Finally, Nikki, Vlahovic at Fiorentina, lots of people suggesting he's going to go somewhere. Do you think he will? And if someone in the Premier League got him, for example, would they be happy about it?
Yeah, one of the most exciting young players in Italian football at the moment, for sure. Not Italian, but playing in Italy. He scored 20 goals at Fiorentina last season, even though Fiorentina were dismal. Really physically impressive young man, and who has that edge about him. I don't know how to explain it sometimes. I think it's a bit like actually what Archie was talking about with Haaland, and just, no, this is my penalty, what are you talking about? Certain strikers you see in them, even from a young age, are just so absolutely convicted that they are doing the right thing and that this is going to go their way. And I feel like that about Vlahovic. Fiorentina are not going to sell him cheaply. They are very conscious that they have an asset of high value. They don't want to sell him this season at all. But if the price is right, the price is right. And I suppose the most obvious candidate, if it was going to be someone, would be if Tottenham sell Harry Kane and bring in the sort of sum that has been talked about for Harry Kane. Then that would be somewhere where I could see a club that might actually spend the money. Because I think it would be not a Harry Kane size figure, but a really substantial figure that would be needed to get him out of Fiorentina right now.
All right, that'll do for part two. In part three, Lars takes us to his tapas bar and his boulangerie.
See.
Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Can we start with Barcelona, Lars?
Hola,
¿cómo estás?
Yeah, no, of course. I suppose the big story in La Liga this weekend was that Barcelona played their first game in the sort of post-Messi era, where they beat Real Sociedad 4-2 at home. Now, they've won something like either the last 24 or the last 25 games at home to Real Sociedad. They always seem to beat them at Camp Nou, so maybe it's not a big deal that they did. But there were big positives in this game. In the first half in particular, they were very good. They looked vibrant and exciting, you know, kept pouring forwards. And listen, let's get this right. There's no case to be made that they'll be better without Messi. Like, that's not what's going on. You know, Messi's unique. He's incredible. He's been carrying the team and the club. So don't get me wrong. You take Messi out of a team and replace him with Memphis Depay, you know, that team has become less good at football. I think we can all agree with that. But that doesn't mean there can't be some upsides amidst all the negatives. And one potential upsides is that maybe you now have 10 outfield players who all run around even when they don't have the ball, compared to just having 9. And there could be something good there. Having said that, Memphis's work rate without the ball isn't amazing either. But he seemed very up for it in this game. And listen, it's one game. It's a game they usually win anyway. But I think what Koeman said, Ronald Koeman, the coach, said after the game was quite significant. He said, "I think our game can be more collective than before." Now, he did specify, "I prefer to have Messi in my team." I think most people understand that's the case. But he did say, if we don't have the player, it has to be the collective. And I think there are possibilities there. So they won 4-2. Two goals from Martin Braithwaite. A player who I think a lot of people were expecting them to try to sell, and they could still try to sell him in their desperate search for money. But so far, no one has wanted to take their breath away, as it were. And he scored two goals there. Okay, it's fine. It works.
I really like a stand-up comic who explains that it's fine. That joke is good. No, that is funny. That's funny.
Sometimes you just need some reassurance, mate. But there was a nice little detail. which I think Sid really honed in his piece, and rightly so, is that the first goal of the game for Barcelona was scored by Gerard Piqué from a free kick that was put in by Memphis Depay. Now, Memphis Depay could only be registered for this game because Piqué decided to take a big wage cut. So by giving up a big chunk of his salary, Piqué got a new teammate, and the first goal they scored after that was Depay delivering a set piece right to Piqué's magnificent big noggin. So that was quite poetic.
How heroic has Piqué been? He said, "I did what was needed. I was born here, grew up here. I came as a fan and a player. It's been 17 months without the fans. To hear them was amazing." His pay cut, you know, a lot of fans say you could just take a 50% pay cut. Why not? I don't know how much that Piqué's was, but you know, it's sort of blithely said about players. How much money do you need?
Yes.
You know?
It's something that's often said by people who will never be in a position to give away that amount of money. and I think, you know, as someone who's deeply cynical about footballers and their motivations for doing anything, I think you have to say, you know, Piqué is a guy who really is a Barcelona guy and who cares very deeply about where the club goes, someone who will almost certainly be a club president at some point. And it's not out of character for him to be leading the way here. And I suspect we'll see other of the big earners, like, you know, Jordi Alba, maybe Busquets, these sort of guys, take wage cuts in the future as well. We had a tweet asking about this, like, how can there be transfer rumours when they can only just about register the players they have? I mean, they haven't in the case of Sergio Aguero, hasn't been registered yet, and he seems to want to leave already. But one solution could be if they could convince some of the other high earners on their books to take similarly dramatic cuts, that might open up the possibility of registering an extra player. So if they could get someone in on a free or on a swap deal, then maybe it's possible. I don't particularly think the Aubameyang rumours are true. That would be bizarre, even by Barcelona standards. But it's not impossible.
Producer Ian saying Aguero could go to PSG, couldn't he? Could play just behind Messi and Ronaldo.
With Ronaldo as well, so it would be good. No, the rumour, and I should reference the very excellent Phil Kitramalidis of La Liga TV, good friend and partner in crime of Sid's, who suggested that, well, from his sources, that Aguero is looking to leave and is looking to get a move to MLS this winter.
All right. Sid had talked about, you know, Barcelona's financial situation. On Monday, the president, Joan Laporta, revealed the club's debt is 1.35 billion. Its value is minus 451 million euros. Salaries account for 103% of total income, even after Messi's departure. And they've taken out a loan of 550 million euros. I mean, you just presume they'll find a way, right? That is just, I can't imagine, you couldn't imagine. I mean, those figures are not good. If a normal business went to a bank and said this, the bank would probably say, you know, in Dragon's Den, they would say, perhaps you should do something else.
Yeah, it's like, it reminds, it's like the technician from Chernobyl who goes, well, it's not great.
Yeah.
You've now got me thinking, Max, what would Deborah Meaden say?
So I've got experience in the leisure industry in the West Country. So, you know, we could move the new camp to Cheltenham and, you know, give it a go. I like you. I would invest in you, but it's a lifestyle business, you know. And really, all you want is Peter Jones's money anyway.
Now, I think there is a genuine risk. In terms of, in the big picture, I think there's a genuine risk of Barcelona sort of going into a state of decline. I mean, but the good news is for them is that they are still, as much as they're in a hole, when we get back to normality, touch wood, and fans are back in the stadium and the things kind of get back to where they were, they will still generate an awful lot of cash, certainly compared to the other clubs in La Liga, if not compared to the other clubs in around Europe. And they'll still have an incredible pulling power. And they still have, I mean, they're still able to produce and attract good young players. So if you look at the squad here, there are guys who, and I know this was always going to happen. This is what happens when a great player who's been carrying a team leaves. We always sit here and say, well, other players can step up now. But it is kind of true. And you look at someone like Griezmann, who is a good footballer. He's just not always looked at Barcelona. But also the younger guys like Pedri, like Frankie de Jong, who's fantastic at his best, Ansu Fati when he gets fit, Dembele if he's ever fit. But there are good players here, and Barcelona will still be Barcelona. So it is really interesting to follow them this season, how it goes, whether they can try to, you know, stay near the top or whether they will collapse completely. But a win against Real Sociedad is a good start anyway.
We all want a Barcelona-PSG draw in the Champions League, don't we? I mean, I think it could happen. I think
yeah, Braithwaite to score the winning goal. I'm completely here for it.
Gareth Bale's chaos was unleashed. He started a game for the football team that he plays for. I mean, that is wild.
I mean, if you compare to the last sort of year, it's a pretty wild development that he's playing for Real Madrid.
And,
and it was remarkably unremarkable. As you say, he started for Real Madrid as they beat Alaves 4-1. And I mean, he wasn't amazing, but he wasn't bad, and he looked in decent nick physically. And you know why he's there? Like, you're not going to be able to get him to leave, because again, no, I think it's going to be hard to get someone to even do what Spurs did and cover about half of his wages. I think that's also way too much compared to what people are willing to contribute to Gareth Bale right now. So if you're stuck with him, you know, might as well play him and give him a chance to do something, because he is still a good player and can be a good player, as we've seen in flashes for Spurs, as we saw for Wales during the summer. So this sort of the sort of reclamation project of Real Madrid, of having sort of Bale and Hazard in the starting lineup, would have been one of the scariest lineups 5 years ago, and is sort of slightly less so now. I think another thing that's kind of interesting to follow this season: Hazard, I thought, looked very lively against Alaves. He had this sort of great flicked assist, which, if you've spent any time on social media this weekend, you will have seen. The other thing, I guess, going on, and Benzema was really good. Ancelotti talking after the game about how Benzema is a more complete player than the last time Ancelotti was at the club, scoring 2 goals and just really aging very, very well, Benzema is. From an English perspective, I suppose the interesting thing here is that Martin Ødegaard looks like he's off to Arsenal, and it might even be at Arsenal by the time this gets edited and published. He wasn't given a shirt number, which is never a great sign, and one of those things. And I think his situation at Real Madrid, I think he was, as I understand it, he was very motivated to play for them and to prove his worth. But he does want to play regularly this season. He's been very clear on that. And it doesn't seem like Ancelotti is kind of up for that. And so if a transfer to Arsenal can be worked out, which recent reports last night suggest, then that makes sense for all parties, really.
He would have headed away that long throw, I'm sure he would have done. Elsewhere... fun game at Valencia against Getafe. 3 red cards.
Yes, I'm really glad you brought that up. I wanted to talk about that.
Talk about it.
Valencia are now coached by José Bordalás, which is interesting because, I mean, it's a bit reductive to say he's kind of a Spanish Sean Dyche, because, I mean, I don't think no one can really imagine such a thing. But he's a coach who's been in charge of Getafe for the last 5 years and overperformed hugely with them, taking Getafe to the Europa League, which is incredible, and done so by being sort of very well organized, quite direct, you know, like some high pressing here and there, but a more destructive than creative team, and very niggly. They've picked up the most yellow cards in the league 2 seasons running. You know, he is that sort of coach. And he's now moved to Valencia, which I kind of, you know, Valencia still see themselves as a big club. They've been sliding towards mediocrity for a bit, but a guy like Bordalás at a club like Valencia, it's kind of an interesting match. First game of the season, obviously the gods of football have pitted them against Getafe, the club he overperformed with for so long. So that's kind of an interesting thing. Now, the old Bordalás team versus the new Bordalás team, what happens? Well, it ended the way they had to, with a red card after 32 seconds. It did take VAR a while to figure it out, but the tackle itself was after 31, 32 seconds, and it was for Valencia, their defensive midfielder Hugo Guillamon, put in a fairly brainless lunge. It was one of those where you part of figured, you know what, it's 30 seconds into the season, I'm not going to get a straight red for this, I'm just gonna throw myself in here, and the ref was like, no, actually, you are going to get a straight red for that. But Valencia ended up taking the lead, through a penalty and 1-1 end. Now, they had 4 shots to Getafe's 22. So, magnificently, this was Bordalás deploying the sort of dark magic that he used to work for Getafe against Getafe. And Valencia picked up 6 yellow cards in addition to that red. So one game down, and the Bordalas team is now the team that has the most bookings in the league, which is, you know, as it's been for the last 2 years, I suppose.
Before we go to the Boulangerie, just say well done to Eric Lamella. He only scored one goal last season for Spurs. It was a good one. It was that Rabona. But he got two in 45 minutes on his debut for Sevilla in their 3-0 win over Rayo Vallecano. And I think everybody is happy for him.
How many of those goals were Rabonas?
Yeah. It was not Rabonas, wasn't it? One deflected, one tapping. But a goal's a goal, isn't it? Well done, Eric. Lars, come to the Boulangerie with me.
Oui.
Allez. Welcome me in. I mean, there was one PSG sort of tweeted out, you know, was it Neymar and Messi scoring a goal in training, which basically was just like a side foot pass and a side foot pass. It was like the most unexciting, and I think people filming training is pretty boring anyway, but it really was so,
yes,
unmomentous, if that's a word. But yes, it is still a thing.
It's still a thing. He didn't play at the weekend because he's not quite ready. So we did have the sort of slightly strange spectacle of Paris Saint-Germain basically picking apart Strasbourg in the first half with sort of Messi and Neymar sort of looking pretty disinterested in the stands. It was like they weren't like, way, we've scored a goal, this is incredible. It was more like they were looking at a fish tank where the fish were sort of moving in a pleasing pattern or something. It was like, oh, yeah, this is okay. That was the level of engagement from the stands. It got more interesting this game in the second half because PSG had gone 3-0 up in the first half hour. And then in the second half, they sort of put their foot off the gas and conceded two goals. And it got a bit interesting. But Strasbourg couldn't quite get an equaliser. And in the end, PSG won 4-2. So I guess that was that. I thought the more interesting story in the Boulangerie this weekend was Lille versus Nice. And there's a bit of context here, which is, of course, as you remember, last season Lille won the title, coached by Christophe Galtier, won the league, won coach of the year, obviously. And then he resigned immediately after winning the league, which might seem weird, but he insisted that, because what was his line? I have a deep belief that my time is up, he said. And I think it's worth noting that Lille was sort of sold off to a sort of Luxembourg-based investment fund after the previous owner failed to keep up with his debts to an American hedge fund, Cohn Elliott, who, by the way, are the guys who repossessed Milan. So off the field, things are a little bit messy at Lille. Luis Campos, the very clever sporting director who put together the title-winning squad, he already left after the change of ownership. So you could see that maybe Galtier felt, I've definitely peaked here when they won the league. Like, this is not getting better. This is probably going to get worse in a hurry. So he left Lille and to take over Nice. So it might seem eccentric to leave the champions to take over the team that finished ninth. But again, Nice are owned by Ineos, the company of Sir Jim Ratcliffe. Galtier is from the South Coast, so he's taken over a slightly more stable project, gets to live closer to home, so it kind of makes sense. But again, the gods of football, second round of the season, pits Galtier's new club, Nice, against his old club, the reigning champions, Lille, which is interesting, I think, and maybe underscoring Galtier's decision in leaving the champions and going to Nice. He took his Nice team to Lille and won 4-0. Just a complete wipeout. Could have been a lot more. Nice looking very good. Lille not looking as good. What does that mean? Well, it's one game. Who knows? But, you know, it was quite interesting anyway.
Brought them to their Nice, if you will.
Oh, yes. Yes, Archie.
Lars, you're inspiring.
It's good. It's good. You know, Archie, you don't have to say it's good. Trust me. It's a good one. Listen, thanks, everybody. That'll do for today. While we're collecting academic qualifications, after me and Barry were given a PhD on Monday, Sir Giles says, I also successfully defended my PhD dissertation last month. And the Football Weekly has been a companion throughout, so it means that now Max and Barry and the rest of the panel are experts in wheat genetic diversity and population structure. So that's good. Thank you very much, Sir Giles. And we discovered that Paul McInnes has no furniture. Ben says, I have a free futon that I also got for free. Dog has chewed the legs a bit. Pick up in Washington, D.C. No delivery. So while we furnish Paul's house, thank you so much, Ben. That was the only offer we got. I mean, I thought we'd get more, but, you know, it's early days.
Max, I've got an awning if anyone wants it.
Oh, yeah, an awning's good. Paul will take anything. He hasn't got anything.
You've got to be very careful of what you wish for when it comes to asking for furniture. I lived in Finland for a bit, and when I first moved there, someone at work, in a group meeting at work, someone asks, you know, Lars, how are you? How are you settling in? I said, it's pretty good, but like, I don't have a lot of furniture. Like, I've got no lamps in the flat at all. It gets a bit dark in the evening. It's really weird. And like the next day at work, like 7 people turned up with lamps. I had so many fucking lamps, like there was nowhere to put them all. And I couldn't turn it down because they were all being very polite and just they kept giving me lamps. And I had way too many lamps in my flat.
When they came over for dinner, you'd have to remember which lamp, who had given you which lamp. Oh no.
It's a really strange sort of interior decoration scheme where there was still almost no furniture, but now way too many lamps.
Wow. It's good to learn that there are 7 lamps for every fin. Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you, Nikki.
Thanks.
Cheers, Lars.
Anytime, Max.
Thanks, Archie.
Cheers, Bob.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.